Hello, Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hey, Bill.
So, you've yet to make it up here to Northern DMZ, but in your stead, we had in town last night Carl Rove.
Oh, wow. As Carl does when I can't make it to gigs, sometimes they'll, you know, throw a bone to Carl to do a spot for me.
So he was.
Are you wearing a hat, Bill? Are you wearing your hat right now?
I'm not wearing my hat. I finally got a haircut, so I'm not wearing my hat.
All right, I was going to put on my Nationals hat.
You're free. This is one hat per show.
One hat per show. We got a match.
So Rove was speaking at UMass Amherst. So the headline of my local paper is "Critics Blast Rove at Packed UMass Talk." And I always find bizarre / annoying the standard. I'm going to protest the fact that you were invited to speak here. Protest.
Right.
Why not just go to the talk, and if you have something critical to say, say it in the Q&A, and here's his response, and you know, so be like, what? I never really understood the value of the "how dare you come to my campus," you know, protest.
Me neither, but yet it seems to go on and on and on and on. And it's a shame. I think we should encourage discussion and debate. And yeah, I agree with you on that. And by the way, we need to do, I there's clamoring for this, I'm sure, you and me and you, to do a college tour or something where we go out there, we bring a couple stools out, sit and talk politics. I think that would be delightful.
And someone's going to protest one of us.
Yes, and as long as they're paying us to do this, I'm fine with that. I'm guessing they would be protesting me, because colleges tend to be a hotbed of liberalism.
What if we're at George Mason or Pepperdine?
Ava Marie. Maybe if we're at Regent University or Patrick Henry.
Okay.
Then you might. But I don't think they would protest you, Bill. I think they would try to convert you and welcome you with open arms.
Those are the cultural differences between the left and the right. So this seems to be a week of a division on both sides of the aisle. You have the right being split on guns and immigration. You have the left being split on the budget and Social Security. And I had a piece up at the week. I haven't gotten nearly as many comments as your piece at the week gets, but I'm closing in.
Well, let me just confess that traffic is about getting Real Clear Politics or Hot Air to link to you. If they do that, then 90% of it's done. They're going to drive traffic and comments.
You know what's annoying to me today? Because Real Clear Politics linked to my piece today, and then they took the link down.
That's not that's teasing.
I really
that's
did that.
Teasing. That's even, you know.
So like for 5 minutes at the week site, it said my piece was the most read piece on the site, which I think is all from the Real Clear Politics link. And then 5 minutes later, I checked, and the link was gone.
It is amazing.
And already it's sinking down.
It is amazing how much traffic they drive, and. Thank God for it when they do it. It's so appreciated. But you would think that the thing that you wrote, if it's interesting enough in its own merits, it should get traffic. But a lot of times it's who sees it and who tweets it and who links it.
Anyway, so my piece was the five issues that are dividing the Democrats. You know, we talk a lot on the show about what's been dividing the Republicans lately, all the Shakespearean drama within the conservative movement, and I think one of our faithful commenters said, "Why don't we talk more about internal dynamics of the left?" And I took that to heart. I wrote this piece, and what occurred to me as I was writing it was the divisions on the left are in some ways more boring. They're more wonky, hardcore issue stuff. It's not the big social. It's not like social conservatism
right
versus
now.
kind of fight.
The left has had those fights in the past, obviously, but you're talking at this point.
Yes, but that's not the live fight right now. And the things that they're fighting about right now, I think, are, you know, directly threaten or at least impact Obama's second term agenda. He has to, it's not just he has to find a way to reach out to Republicans to get things through the House or to avoid a filibuster. He has significant fault lines with the Democratic Party that if he can't reconcile, he can't even get to step two. And these are generally all issues that are not the low-hanging fruit. These are the things that that he could not get done in his first term for good reason, because these are the harder fights. And therefore, that's why I think the pace of legislating is a lot slower right now. But the five issues are Social Security, which we're seeing a lot about this week, taxes, which is the other side of that grand bargain coin, trade, which is sort of a sleeper issue right now, climate, and of course I'm going to forget the fifth until I go back and look it up.
Oops. No, well, you know, Rick Perry only.
Guns, of course, the obvious one, guns. But guns are close to reconciling right now. But where were you going to go?
I was going to say Rick Perry couldn't remember three things. It's harder to remember five, but you pulled that one out. So. I think it's a good point, Bill. The left has had their big fights over. I mean, remember Jesse Jackson and Ted Kennedy were pro-life at one point. Al Gore was pro-life. You had Governor Casey who couldn't give a speech at the DNC. I mean, the left has had their hot button.
That Casey anecdote is disputed by the Clintonites, okay. By the way.
I'll put an asterisk on that.
They say it was because he wasn't endorsing the ticket.
I'll put an asterisk on that. But my point is that these battles have been hashed out on the left, the hot button issues, decades ago. So now you're getting down to more nuanced debates over policy issues.
I think on these social questions. It's not like there's non-existent division on abortion and gay rights, for example, but it's, as you saw with the gay marriage tsunami the past week, it's become pretty minor. There are still some anti-abortion Democrats out there. You know, right here in Massachusetts, we have a set of primary between Ed Markey and Stephen Lynch, and Stephen Lynch describes himself as pro-life. He's in Congress right now. He has won his House seat in Massachusetts with that position. He will probably not win the Senate primary because of that stance, but he's not drummed out of the party. And so these are, I think, on the scale of division have become very, very low.
I also think that because Democrats have been winning, there's not the urgency to change things, but you will see, and I think we're beginning to see, liberals and the left push further to the fringes and feel more empowered and emboldened to kind of fly their freak flag because, hey, we're winning. There's, you know, the culture. We've not only are we winning elections, but we've won the culture. And so why should we push down our instinct to just be ourselves and to sort of speak truth to power. Whereas on the right, I think the soul searching is much more negative, and it's like it's more of a desperation happening.
Well, what you're getting at, I think, gets into this whole Melissa Harris Perry controversy, which I do want to talk to you about. But let me put that aside for a second and start with the more boring stuff. Because I think the flip side of what you're talking about is, since Democrats are winning, they're not having these big, grand, soul-searching, what does it mean to be a Democrat kind of fights that they were having in the 80s and 90s. But you're now now you're having the rubber hits the road. Okay, what's the actual policy going to be arguments that got pushed down while Democrats are out of power? And now you have a question, okay, what is the best way to maintain Social Security solvency? What is the best way to have reform the Republican trade approach? Do we actually have consensus on climate when a whole bunch of us come from green states like California and a bunch of us come from coal states like Ohio or Colorado, for example. Those things are starting and because some of these issues are pushed by one side of the base, like climate, these are issues that maybe the party elders might want to push off for a while if they could. If they don't, they don't want to force a confrontation, they don't have to. But you have a legitimate argument from the environmentalists, like, look, the climate is a ticking timer. You got to do something about it. Guns, which is an issue that wasn't even a campaign issue in 2012 or 2008, for that matter. The Democrats have for a while pushed that down on the list following Tom Schaller's advice, the political scientist who wrote Whistling Past Dixie. Look, you're not going to win. You're never going to win the South. Forget the South. You're not going to win that for a generation. There's too many hurdles to overcome culturally to win there. But in the West and the interior, in the Midwest, if you can shelve guns, they'll hear you out on your economic views. Obama did that. Obama did not run as a gun control advocate. He supported the Supreme Court ruling in 2008 that upheld the individual right to bear arms. And he won in Colorado, and he won in Indiana, and he won in Ohio, and he won in Nevada, places where Gore and Kerry did not win. So they're not itching to have this fight. But then Newtown comes along, and on the heels of Aurora and the Sikh temple shootings, and finally the base is like, enough. You cannot sit there and do nothing. You have to face up to this. And the combination of that level of outrage, the lack of a re-election campaign for Obama, those two factors combined to say, okay, this divide still exists. There's a rural-urban divide in the party still, and probably always will be, because the country is divided along those lines on some issues. The Senate is weighted towards rural states, so that they have a leg up there. You have to face up this divide somehow. And I didn't get to this in the piece, but the compromise that's probably going to be broached today by Manchin, classic rural Democrat, and Toomey, swing state Republican, even though he's considered very conservative, centering on background checks, which is the same exact issue that Democrats danced around when they passed the Brady Bill in 1983, when George Mitchell was a rural Senate majority leader from Maine, where the big hunting state. He was not a big gun control guy. Found a way to find middle ground on background checks, and that's what got the bill through. So we're maybe not literally running in place. I still argue that perhaps this is still an advance from where we were in 93, but it's sort of very slow from a gun control perspective, because these divides exist. Obama is having to navigate it. I think he is successfully navigating it to a large extent, but you see how painstakingly slow it is, and how ginger it is, which is why you don't have this rush of legislative activity that you did when you could jam, 50 different issues into the Recovery Act and get it passed in 6 weeks, which was 2009. So I don't know what your take is on all that. I know it's a lot to throw at you. I know there's probably a lot to say about Toomey and guns on its own outside of the division of the Democratic Party, but that's sort of where I see Obama's second-term agenda resting
upon.
Well,
two quick things come to mind, Bill. I mean, one obvious point is that you talked about Whistling Past Dixie, and the obvious point is that the western part of the United States, what we would call Westerners, tend to be more libertarian, and that's where Reagan's from, that's where Goldwater's from, and it's quite different than the Deep South brand of conservatism. And so, yes, they would cling to their guns out there because it's the Wild West, and I summer in Arizona, which is a weird place to summer, but every year I spend a week in Scottsdale. Every summer I spend a week in Scottsdale.
It's because you love dry heat or you love air conditioning.
And swimming pools and desert and quiet. And I like cheap hotels, too, which if you go off season, you get. But, I went on this desert tour this past summer out in the desert, miles and miles away from people. And it's very dangerous out there. And you couldn't survive very long. If somebody, if a highwayman were to mug you or steal your car or something, you would perish in the desert, obviously. You wouldn't last too long without water out there. And everybody kind of carries a gun. And our we rented this SUV and had a driver who had a gun on. And very happy to see him have that gun when we would occasionally run across people out there. So it is different, and I think that but they tend to be libertarian and other, they're not caught up on social issues. So it was probably a smart move. Obviously, Newtown changed the political dynamic, but I'm fascinated in the disparate wings of conservatism, so I wanted to bring that up. I think Pat Toomey is another...
But so the question is, by pushing Newtown, are Democrats going to risk losing these western states now, or are they finding a sweet spot where they seem like reasonable, middle-of-the-ground folks who are not trying to take your gun away, but trying to do something to deal with what most folks think is a serious problem?
Well, it will be interesting. Obviously, a couple of the most horrific mass shootings have happened in Colorado, and that's a very important, you know, swing state, purple state.
And they just passed their own regulations this past month, which was unusual for Colorado to do, and they didn't even pass that stuff after Columbine.
Exactly. So we'll see what happens, but I think they have to tread carefully. I think Pat Toomey's interesting too, Bill. I wrote about this today at the Daily Caller. I mean, Pat Toomey was twice national conservatives backed him in this bid to oust, you know, then Republican Senator Orrin Hatch. And, you know, Arlen Specter. I'm confusing my establishment Republicans. You'll forgive me. Thank you for catching that. I appreciate that. The worst thing is when no one catches it, and then we hear. I figure it out when I watch it, and then the commenters think I'm an idiot. Arlen Specter, the late Arlen Specter. National conservatives supported Toomey twice. The first time, Specter narrowly survived the primary and went on to win re-election. The second time, Specter fled the party once it became clear that Toomey would win, and Toomey ended up winning the general election. And now he's a senator, and he's doing pretty much what Arlen Specter always did, which is sort of work across the aisle as a statesman, finding bipartisan compromise. Now, we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but a half hour from now, we're taping, he will apparently be holding a press conference with West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, where they will propose some sort of watered-down compromise on universal background checks. But I do think it's interesting, two things. One, that conservatives went to bat so hard for Toomey twice, and he's now basically become pretty much a center-right slash establishment Republican, certainly not a hardcore conservative fighter, as you might have thought. The other thing that I find interesting is, I think there was a sense in 2010 when all these Tea Party candidates like Rubio and Rand Paul and Pat Toomey got elected that, oh my gosh, we're electing these crazy right-wing conservatives who can never work across the aisle and who are going to be extremists. And here you have Pat Toomey forging this bipartisan deal on guns, Marco Rubio working in a bipartisan, you know, leading a bipartisan deal on immigration reform, and even Rand Paul supporting, you know, Mitch McConnell for re-election in Kentucky. So I think the hand wringing that we were electing these extreme conservatives, Tea Partiers in 2010 seems to be overwrought as well.
Now, what is the Toomey calculus? He hasn't done anything to suggest a need to be bipartisan up until now. Do you think he feels like, look, Pennsylvania is a swing state. It did vote for Obama. I can't just be a diehard conservative and hold on to the seat. I gotta break ranks somewhere, sometime. And this is a pretty minor concession on background checks. Therefore, this is a good place to do it. What other rationale would he, or is it just a miscalculation on his part that he doesn't really have to do this, and he thinks he has to, and he's going to sacrifice his Republican base
Bill, I'll be honest with you. I feel like Toomey has, from day one, once being elected, has governed, if legislators governed, as a sort of moderate center-right Republican. I don't feel like he's ever, the sense was when he ran, because he ran the Club for Growth before, and obviously the Club for Growth is hardcore fiscal conservative, and they go after Republicans, moderate Republicans. So I think the sense was that he was going to be this hardcore Tea Party conservative rabble rouser. My sense is the entire last 2 years, 2 or 3 years that he's been in the Senate, he really has been sort of a mainstream establishment Republican, which is not horrible. But and look, I think he probably prudently takes his reelection very seriously. Pennsylvania is a very difficult state. But if you're going to make excuses for him, why not make excuses for Arlen Specter? Why not say, hey, Pennsylvania is a tough state. Yeah, he's got a.
But do you think what Pat Toomey has done, it rises the level of the number? I mean, Specter was a critical vote of passing the Recovery Act. I mean, does this rise to that level of party betrayal?
Well, and Arlen Specter also did great, conservative things too, like, defending Clarence Thomas, I believe. Am I right about that, Bill? So he had a mixed record. But look, Toomey's only been in office for a couple years, and so who knows what he's going to develop into over time. The question is, did conservatives sort of put themselves out there and oust somebody only to have the guy that they replaced him with essentially be the same? Now, yes, your point is well taken. It's too early to say that. And it could be that this is a smart move. It could be that Republicans ought to embrace some sort of really limited, watered-down background check and that this is good for conservatism to sort of stanch the bleeding. So I don't want to like make too much of this. I just think it is interesting that Pat Toomey, I think, was sold as too conservative for Pennsylvania. That's how he was cast by his enemies, and in some ways, I think even his national conservatives kind of hoped that would be the case. And it turns out that maybe that's not that true. And I think it's a microcosm of a larger thing, which is the same thing with Rubio. If there was a fear that these Tea Party, Republicans elected in 2010 were going to be, upsetting the apple cart all the time and extremists, yada, 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 then it doesn't really bear out. I mean, here we have Rubio working across the aisle on immigration reform and Pat Toomey working across the aisle on gun control. Both of these candidates elected in 2010 in the year of the Tea Party. Both ran against establishment Republicans, Charlie Crist in the case of Rubio, who fled the party, and Arlen Specter in the case of Pat Toomey, who fled the party.
Well, shouldn't this be a lesson for both left and the right? If you're going to elect somebody who has to in the Senate, who's going to represent the whole state, and it's a swing state, or even a blue state or opposite of where your party's at, no matter how conservative they are deep down inside, they're going to have to bend somewhere to maintain their perch in a state like that. It's just untenable to be a purist. I mean, Rick Santorum only could do it for so long until he eventually got tossed out in a landslide. Right. So if you want to keep somebody there, they're going to have to bend somewhere somehow. And if you have a unreasonable expectation, if you think Scott Brown could have been pure Tea Party and kept that seat, that just doesn't make any sense. I think there are other examples. For example, like you take what the left did with Joe Lieberman or what the left did with Blanche Lincoln. You could plausibly say in Connecticut, We don't need a right-leaning Democrat in Connecticut. We can have a real Democrat in Connecticut of all places. Let's plant our flag here and shove this guy out. Now it happened to backfire because he went third party on you. And perhaps that was not something that could have easily been foreseen. But I think there's more logic there. Blanche Lincoln, look, it's Arkansas. You're not going to get a liberal in Arkansas. So why are you planting your flag there? It doesn't make any sense. Some conservatives might take a run at Lindsey Graham in South Carolina. I can see doing that. You can have a Jim DeMint win in South Carolina, but Pennsylvania, look, the guy's going to compromise on something. It's going to happen.
Well, look, I think in the case of Rubio especially, I wouldn't want to imply that immigration reform is some calculation to get reelected. Or, you know, I think that for Rubio, that is a principled issue. I don't know about Toomey, but who knows? I don't want to necessarily attribute bad motives to him.
Let's shift immigration for a second, because that's also, you know, this is actually, you know, pretty good week for Obama, I'd say, with immigration and guns being so close to being realized so early in the second term. But Rubio, so you get two dynamics here. Play one, they're close to a deal, but Rubio is saying you got to do this on a slow track. We can't just bring this straight to the floor of the Senate. We got to put it through the committee, give lots of chances for amendments, have a protracted debate. Well, let's make everyone feel like they got their say. And you have this dueling think tank war where Heritage is putting out reports suggesting this is going to be some kind of giant budget buster. And you got Cato out there saying Heritage's methodology is junk and should be totally dismissed. Is this something that is, within conservative circles, who's coming out looking better for this? I mean, from my perspective, I always thought Heritage was a two-bit propaganda shop. So I'm sort of happy to see Cato call them out on it, but I imagine most conservatives don't see it that way.
Well, it's interesting, Bill. There's a lot of dynamics here. First, Heritage of late has come out in favor of chain CPI. They have come out. Just today, I'm looking at least on their website, they're against breaking up the big banks, which a lot of conservatives are in favor of, including Jim Pethikoukas at AEI, who's kind of led the charge on that. And now on immigration, they're taking a very I'll just back up and tell the story. There's a lot of components here, but essentially in 2007, the Heritage Foundation issued a report on immigration, which a lot of people think doomed it, doomed the 2007 effort for comprehensive immigration reform. And when they scored their economic analysis, when they scored the cost of immigration, they used static scoring rather than dynamic scoring, which basically means they looked at the cost of immigration, like an extra immigrant is going to cost us X in terms of, I don't know, welfare or whatever, Social Security, who knows. But they didn't consider the advantages or the benefits. Well, what if this immigrant starts a business? What if this immigrant provides additional cheap labor for business? What impact might that have? So they looked at essentially the static scoring, which conservatives on tax issues always decry. They say, you can't say, if you're going to, you know, the Congressional Budget Office scores a tax cut, you can't look at the cost of the tax cut without considering it might spur the economy or whatnot. So you have to look at it from that perspective. And so it is anticipated that Heritage will is preparing to once again put out another immigration report, which will look at the cost of immigration and will probably be static, not dynamic, and could torpedo immigration reform right now at a very key moment, because it could scare off conservatives who are sort of wavering conservatives. And in preparation for that, we've seen Marco Rubio's chief of staff, Cesar Conda, tweeting about the importance of dynamic scoring. Doug Holtz-Eakin, who is an economist. I think he was head of CBO in the Bush years. He, I think, ran McCain's economic shop in the presidential race. He's come out in the Washington Post talking about the need to score immigration reform dynamically. And in addition to that, Americans for Tax Reform and the Cato Institute have taken shots at the Heritage Foundation preemptively. Now, the final point that I'll make on this is an interesting one, which is that Marco Rubio might not be in the U.S. Senate if it wasn't for Jim DeMint. If you read Rubio's book, he credits DeMint's early support as being very influential. And Rubio recently told GQ magazine that next to his wife, Jim DeMint's his best friend. Jim DeMint now heads the Heritage Foundation. which we believe will soon put out this report, which could torpedo Marco Rubio's landmark legislation. And DeMint has an interesting background on immigration going back to 2007. As you recall, the bill was, a lot of people think it was going to pass. And at the last minute, Byron Dorgan, then a senator from North Dakota, introduced this poison pill amendment, which was against the guest worker program and favored labor unions. Barack Obama voted for that amendment, and so did Jim DeMint. So Jim DeMint voted for this amendment that favored labor unions as a way to essentially kill immigration reform. Now he heads the Heritage Foundation. So could Jim DeMint once again be the man who torpedoes immigration reform and kills the landmark legislation of his protege? This is, I mean, I know it's nerdy and wonky and in the weeds, but it's sort of a soap opera too, though.
But I mean, you're someone who, you're a pro-immigration reform conservative. You've made a conservative case for it on the merits, so I assume you must be in contact with other like-minded conservatives on the subject. You sort of, you know where those folks are. Are those folks, are there enough of those folks to marginalize Heritage this time around that they, in a way that they couldn't in 2007? And is Cato helping that cause?
Well, I think that they may because they're proactive. I think that there's been a clearly concerted effort amongst Senate, the Gang of Eight, their staff, and the Cato Institute, and Grover Norquist, Americans for Tax Reform, and Holtz Eakin. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. I would see it in front. Clearly, there's been a concerted effort to preempt the Heritage Foundation's forthcoming study and undermine it and discredit it. And to do it, to take the moral high ground of the Jack Kemp dynamic scoring argument. And so I suspect that they may have limited the impact that the Heritage Foundation's reports, assuming that it comes out and assuming that it does what everyone fears, everyone who supports immigration reform fears it will do, that they may have limited the impact. Because last time, it's widely believed to have been, very important in terms of torpedoing immigration reform. Bill, there's another story today in the Wall Street Journal, too, that shows that the senators pushing for immigration reform are going to be, very tough on border security. And I think that's really important because a lot of the people who are skeptical, who worry about immigration reform, don't believe that there's going to be any real effort to secure the border. And if they were convinced, and for a good reason they're skeptical, but if they are convinced, if they were convinced that we could actually secure the border, then I think they'd be much more willing to accept, comprehensive immigration reform.
So, forgive me for being obsessed about Heritage here, which is probably not the most important aspect of this whole discussion. But I'm curious if Heritage is seen as being not on the level and not accepting the fact that there is border security here, making disingenuous arguments about cost, using a self-serving methodology that's not really accurate. Does that hurt the reputation amongst conservatives beyond this issue? Or will everyone just say, look, this is immigration. It's divisive for us. We know it's divisive for us. When it's over, let's all be a happy family again.
Well, I think the Heritage Foundation has, on the right, has a lot of political capital built up. I mean, they're very highly regarded, which is why this study is feared. They're thought of as being they're a very respected think tank on the right, and so I don't think any one thing could destroy their credibility. However, I would say that in recent years, there have been more and more criticism toward them, and when they hired Jim DeMint, or when they installed Jim DeMint to replace Ed Fulner as as president of the Heritage Foundation, there were some, and I like Jennifer Rubin, for example, at the Washington Post, who thought that was a bad idea, that it was that think tanks ought to be intellectual places for, you know, wonks, and that by taking someone like DeMint, who's more of a partisan political brawler, and making him head of a think tank, that could diminish the reputation of the organization. In the case of immigration, it's hard to make that case, because remember in 2007, long before DeMint was at Heritage, they scored the immigration the same way. So it's hard to argue that DeMint is responsible for this new thing, which hasn't even come out yet. So I guess a long answer to your question is, I think there is a danger that Heritage could eventually be seen as more of a partisan outlet as opposed to an intellectual think tank. But I don't think that there's any danger of that happening imminently, just because they're so highly regarded and they've built up so much capital over the years.
Now, I want to get back to an issue you were, I think, moving towards earlier in the show, which is are liberals letting their freak flag fly now?
I hate to interrupt you, but I'm on Twitter right now. DeMint-led Heritage Action. This is Heritage Action, the political arm.
Right, which is their political
Heritage
wing.
Heritage Action,
right?
Comes out against Schumer, Toomey, Manchin, Kirk, gun compromise. So.
So everyone's name is on it now. They got two Republicans on it.
I'm reading a tweet from the Washington Post, Aaron Blake. DeMint-led Heritage Action comes out against Schumer, Toomey, Manchin, Kirk, gun compromise. So, I mean, clearly they're this is the political arm, but they're clearly acting fast on breaking news and hot button issues here. This isn't an organization that puts out a white paper a year later examining the economic, you know, costs of gun control or something. I mean, they're moving quickly.
Right. Now, while the right has been bedeviled by dealing with guns and immigration and as well as the budget, trying to maintain unified and having a hard time with that, it seemed like they found an opportunity to target the left again with this MSNBC promo featuring Melissa Harris Perry, where she talks about children not belonging to parents but belonging to the community. And this started this seemed to be, as you were saying earlier, that liberals are letting their freak flag fly. I thought you were alluding to that.
Well, I think that's one of the incidents, one of the examples that I've seen lately. This seems to be a recent trend, but this is one of them.
Right, and so the right seem to treat this as the aha moment, the real liberal agenda. They want to take your children. They think parents should have no say over how their children are raised. All these boogeymen were being floated. Harris Perry, of course, has come out and said, you know, they're twisting my words, essentially. But I know you've taken a pretty firm stance on this whole episode.
I have, Bill, and I tell you why. First, as you know, I'm pretty sympathetic to the communitarian argument as opposed to the libertarian argument, in the sense that I do believe it's appropriate to say, you know, communities are important and it's good for children to have healthy communities, healthy, you know, good neighbors, churches, parks, whatever. I mean, I'm open to that, but Bill, when I read what she said, and I'll read it to you, her exact words, and keep in mind, this isn't something that she said off the top of her head. This isn't something she happened to say in the spur of the moment. This is something that was scripted. This is something she said on a TV ad that somebody at MSNBC greenlit and decided to put on TV. So she goes, we have to break through our kind of private idea that kids belong to their parents or kids belong to their families and recognize that kids belong to the whole community. I think that's kind of scary stuff, Bill. Again, I'm certainly open to the idea that we're all in this together, and communities matter. But when you say we have to get through this private idea that kids belong to their parents or to their families, that concerns me, and it does make me think this is part of a liberal worldview that I think is dangerous, and I think people who are very cognizant of preserving freedom are sensitive to this. And in my piece at the Week, Bill, I could have used Brave New World, but I used two of, I know that George Orwell, who has maybe done as much to raise the consciousness of Americans and everyone around the world of totalitarianism and authoritarianism and of the dangers of the importance of preserving freedom, made it a point in both Animal Farm and 1984 to kind of address this, and I bring that up in my column at the Week. So I know that some people will think this is an overreaction, but this is something that I think we are very, very conscious of. Any idea, any notion that my children, Bill, are not my responsibility, but that's, just the state or the community somehow ought to also have control over them is really scary to a lot of us. And I think that's why you saw the reaction. And again, it's not like she just happened to say this. This was scripted. I think it might have been a case of trolling us too. It's either a case, there's a few possibilities. One possibility is, remember that they did that Reverend Al Sharpton Lean Forward ad where he said one nation indivisible. We have a pastor here clearly leaving out under God, not a pastor, a preacher, because I don't think Al Sharpton has a church. But leaving out the word under God, which was obviously going to spark controversy. And here we have another host really coming close to something that was guaranteed to spark controversy. I wonder if it wasn't a gimmick to get us to talk about her, and we are. But if it wasn't that, it could be an example of the left finally feeling free. We don't have to hide anymore. We don't have to pretend that we're conservative or moderate anymore to win elections, because the world has changed, and now we can be free to let everyone know just how we really believe, our real worldview, that parents don't really belong, that kids don't really belong to their families or their parents, but they really belong to all of us. Communal. Communism. I don't know.
Well, I don't think that is in any way like the liberal view. I don't think it is intrinsic to liberalism that you have to believe that parents, that the children are not primarily their parents' responsibility. That's just not endemic to the ideology. I'm also very wary of any one person speaking for all of us. Some of the same way conservatives don't want to have, Glenn Beck speak for everybody. This is just Melissa Harris Perry. It's not the left. And even though it's MSNBC, MSNBC is not the left. I don't think she actually, the question, one of the questions is, what policies does she mean by saying that? She may hang policies on that that statement that don't actually fit the most Orwellian view that you could attribute to that statement. And therefore it's an example of bad wording and not a nefarious philosophy.
I agree.
But,
I would say, Bill, ideas have consequences. And when she says we have to break through our kind of private idea that kids belong to their parents or kids belong to their families and recognize that kids belong to the whole community, I take her at her word. This was scripted. And that idea, whether she means it or not, is very dangerous, and it has serious consequences, and it is something that they just tried throughout history, Bill. And look, let me go to my Orwell thing, because it's dangerous to use, as I said in my piece, it's dangerous to compare this to other regimes. So Orwell did us a favor by creating these sort of fictional dystopian ideas. But in 1984, he writes, the family could not actually be abolished, and indeed, people were encouraged to be fond of their children in an almost old-fashioned way. The children, on the other hand, were systematically turned against their parents and taught to spy on them and report their deviations. In Animal Farm, Bill, Napoleon the pig, who is said to represent Joseph Stalin, takes away the puppies from their mother, saying, quote, he could make himself responsible for their education. And, of course, we know that later on those same puppies are used by Napoleon to seize control of the Animal Farm. I realize at this point I sound insane. but Orwell was a...
But you know, the point, I mean, you're calling it dangerous. I just call that argument dumb. You know, what she says after that is that we've never invested in public education as much as we should. Well, maybe that's true. You don't have to break through some notion of children being a private responsibility to convince politicians to spend more on public education. Like, you don't have to do that. That's not essential to winning your point. And I used to have some arguments with folks, you know, people I know personally, not politicians or anything, during the healthcare debate. And they would say, you know, we got to get over this notion that everyone get all the healthcare they want. We have to start rationing care. And I'd be like, if someone's got to get there and say that, I'm like, actually, no, they don't. You don't have to ration care to have healthcare reform. That's actually not essential to bending the cost curve. But there are liberals out there that have crude, unsophisticated thoughts like that. I think because they haven't thought through the issue fully and they don't know all the nuances of the subject. So I'm sure you can find individual people left that say dumb things
you're trolling us because it worked. Do you think that she was accidentally revealing a worldview that's dangerous? Or do you believe that they're just incompetent and that they had no idea, didn't mean to offend, had no idea this would be provocative?
I lean towards the latter, and I think talking about the dynamic of what does it mean to liberals that we're winning on a lot of things right now, I think there was this time during the Bush years where there was tons of emphasis on language and framing, where George Lakoff became a star and Drew Weston became a star. Let's think very carefully about the words that we use that are going to communicate our values in a way that resonate with the broader public, and that pressure has subsided, and now I think this is an early example of what does it mean to communicate your view in the dumbest, most ham-handed way possible that completely obscures your actual point. So I'm not afraid. I'm only afraid in that I think she is setting liberals up for more problems by using that kind of language. I don't think the actual ideology she was trying to present is actually scary. I think she has said it in a really stupid way. And at minimum, I don't think you're going to see a lot of liberal proposals that involve taking responsibility away from parents and not letting them be parents. That's just not – I mean, obviously there are concerns that look at things like, you know, we should have sex ed in schools because that's a parent's responsibility. You know, there are obviously issues like that where liberals would say that's ridiculous. It's a public health matter, and we need to have good public health education, not freelance it. You know, I don't look at that as taking my responsibility as a parent. I see that as, I mean, we already have public schooling. You know, we've already had the debate that public schooling is a good, and we do invest in it, and we do teach things in school that. I'm not going to teach my kid math at home. I'm not a homeschooler. Most parents are not. I don't consider it as a fundamental robbing me of my authority as a parent. So that's why I dispute her premise. We don't have to have that argument right now. We've had that argument, and liberals have won that argument. Now, maybe how much you do it, how much you invest in it, what specific things you teach, those arguments still have to get played out. But the fundamental argument's already been won. So I don't think that it's the way she's approaching it, the worldview she's presenting of it is remotely necessary to have a good education about discussion, education.
Well, Bill, let me say, first of all, if all liberals were like you, I wouldn't fear them so much because you're a good person and give good motives. But putting that aside, this ties into a point that I've tried to make in the past, and I'll try to make a little better this time.
Say it quick, because I have to jump to a meeting.
Well, maybe we should save it. You got to go?
I do have to go.
I was going to go on a rant about Chavez and about how the left fears... I'm much more fearful of the left than the right. But I think we're going to have to save that for another time if you got to go. This was going to be epic, my friend. All right.
I do have...
Good show. in any event, good show.
All right, I'll talk to you soon.